This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
There are plenty of three-letter brands out there, IBM, AT&T, also CVS. The one on the spot today, though, the NRA. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, today, the 23rd of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is true that the NRA is not a brand in the conventional sense, right? It's a membership organization, an interest group with a well-oiled lobbying operation. But the National Rifle Association finds itself today having a whole lot of brand-related problems. Companies and fellow brands with which the group used to do business have changed their minds since the shooting in Parkland and the response to it. Enterprise Car Rental, MetLife, the insurance company, Simply Safe, they do home security. They and a handful of others have said they are done. So Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going with this look at brand risk.
Whatever your reaction to the gun rights organization, when you hear those three letters, you know what they stand for.
You say the NRA, and it's got tremendous name recognition, that's for sure.
Jim Andrews is a senior vice president at ESP Properties, a brand consulting firm.
It has a powerful brand, it has a lot of members, but we see what can happen when there is just that single focus.
The NRA says it has 5 million members, and those people are passionate about the cause. Companies want direct access to that group. Partnerships are a great way to get there. But Andrew says the reaction and debate following the shooting in Parkland, Florida has changed that calculus.
The number of people who would say, I'm not going to do business with a company that's a partner of the NRA has not been enough to outweigh those who would. But there seems to have been a tipping point with Parkland.
And the environment for marketing your business is completely different these days. Companies fear what marketing people call brand risk, especially on social media. A single hashtag like boycott NRA that gains momentum can be a real problem for a company's brand.
The idea of partnering with any organization these days carries more risk than it ever has before.
And when a company's called out for a partnership and remains silent, that omission can be as damaging as the affiliation itself, says E.J. Schultz at Ad Age.
I think these brands are probably looking into the totality of the situation and seeing that they have more to gain by actually taking a stand. It feels like a slow trickle that then might start to become more of a flood.
He thinks we're going to see more companies cut ties before this debate dies down. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Parkland and the conversation about it have taken up a whole lot of our collective news brain space this week, but the economy waits for no one. It especially doesn't wait for the next 5 minutes of live radio. What happened economy-wise this week and why? Dion Rabowan is at Yahoo Finance. He is now in our studios in New York to chat things over. Hey.
Hey, Kai. How's it going?
I'm all right. Let's start in no particular order with some of the big reports and releases of information this week. The Fed minutes from their most recent meeting, Janet Yellen's last meeting back in January, they came out and said the economy, by and large, better than they thought it was going to be doing, right?
Yeah. And you know, the expectation was for a positive and strong economy. We got that. There also was a bit of consternation about the unemployment rate and how low it is. And that was something that could be interesting and something to watch because, you know, we've seen these numbers dipping below 4.5%, 4%. You know, the question right now is kind of what is the mark of natural or neutral unemployment? And that's going to be big in determining what the Fed does in its next few meetings in terms of raising rates and its guidance for how they move forward.
And about those next couple of meetings, they also said the short-term impact of the tax changes are going to be generally beneficial. It's going to give the economy a bump, but they don't know what's going to happen in the out years.
Right. And we're in sort of new and uncharted territory because, juicing the economy with $1.5 trillion of tax cuts is not something that's generally done in the eighth year of an expansion. And so we're trying something new, doing something new, and we're going to see how that works out. You know, the Fed isn't sure because they haven't really studied things like this before. And so, you know, they have all kinds of models and estimates, and they've done all kinds of studies, and they read about all this stuff. But, you know, we're still in an environment where we're trying something that hasn't exactly been done before.
Yeah. Just real quick, one more thing on the Fed. Jay Powell, I think, goes to the Hill next week for his first set of testimonies since his confirmation. We're not expecting anything out of the norm, right, from Chairman Powell?
I mean, I would love for something out of the norm from Chairman Powell. You know, he just gets in front of there, hey, I'm Jay Powell. It's time. It's the Powell era.
Oh, man.
But no, I mean, he's generally expected to keep things on the track that former Chair Janet Yellen was on. That was a big part of his attractiveness for the role, you know, that he was kind of going to maintain this sort of policy stance that Chair Yellen had. And so, no, most people are just expecting him to kind of get there, let the Congress know that things are fine and move forward.
Be great, though, if you let his hair down, wouldn't it be?
That'd be fantastic.
That'd be amazing. All right. Elsewise this week, the economic report of the president, the president's first actual official economic report, came out predicting once again 3% economic growth on a continuing basis, not really supported by any other analysis out there.
Mm, yeah, 3% growth forever. I don't know. I mean, why not?
Right.
It's like I said, though, Guy. I mean, we are in uncharted waters, right? I mean, if you believe, as the president said on the campaign trail, that President Obama was, you know, throwing a wet blanket on the economy with overregulation, that he had, you know, was keeping workers out of the workforce by, you know, stopping the by putting regulations
right.
on fuel and oil drilling and things like that, then President Trump's deregulation and, you know, juicing the economy with these tax cuts, the new stimulus, the increased budget measures, that could genuinely shock the economy up and we could start functioning at 3%. There aren't a lot of economists who agree that that's what was happening under Obama, that all these regulations were inherently holding back the economy. But if you do believe that, and that was one of the reasons why you voted for Trump or why one of the reasons you support Trump, then it's not out of the ordinary or unrealistic, really, that this would be the result.
One does imagine, though, I mean, to quote Larry Summers, former president of Harvard, former Secretary of the Treasury, this idea of secular stagnation, right, that for some reason things have changed. And once we get past this sugar high of the tax cuts and regulatory impact, things are going to settle back down. Right. That's the thesis.
Yeah, that's the thesis from The Economist. And that's generally, you know, one reason or another. That's something that economists have really struggled to exactly put their finger on. Why did we have this sort of lower for longer return right. to prosperity of sorts? You know, we saw an increase in employment, but there wasn't this wholesale increase. We did see labor force participation withdraw. We saw, you know, a number of things that were unusual in a recovery, in an economic recovery. And if you believe that there is some explanation like secular stagnation, as Larry Summers does, then not a lot has changed. But if you do believe that there was a crazy socialist who was in the White House and was holding our economy back, then now that he's gone,
yeah,
maybe we can get going to 3% again.
Just real quick, though, in the 30 seconds we have left, people are feeling good out there. I mean, we have to acknowledge that businesses are feeling good, consumers are spending money, and confidence is high, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You look at the latest consumer confidence reports, you look at business confidence, small business and medium-sized businesses especially are feeling really confident right now in the economy.
Right.
And it's not for no reason. You know, people are spending more. We're seeing credit card debt at new all-time highs, savings rates at new all-time lows. And so people are definitely going out there and spending money. And these businesses right now certainly have a reason to be optimistic.
Yep. All right, Dion Rabon at Yahoo Finance on a Friday afternoon. Dion, thanks a lot, man.
Hey, Kai, thanks for having me.
All right, talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, green all the way around on the major indices, green like by a lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Pretty sure I've never said this on the radio before, but here goes. The latest trend in pet food, farm-to-table canine cuisine. You laugh, but General Mills thinks it's worth $8 billion. That's how much it's paying for pet food maker Blue Buffalo. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes us inside the deal and inside this industry.
Natural pet food is the fastest growing piece of the $30 billion U.S. pet food market. It got there partly through commercials like this one about a family dog.
Blue really liked being part of the family. He was the ring bearer in my son's wedding.
These commercials play on owners' desires to spoil their pets, says Ernest Baskin, who teaches marketing at St. Joseph's University.
And I think that right now, pet food companies are capitalizing on how individuals want to treat pets similar to how they treat other humans and only give them the best.
And if the best for us is natural organic food, it stands to reason that the same must be true for pets, right? Not so fast, says Kaylin Hines, who teaches pet nutrition at Tufts University.
It makes a lot more difference to how the pet owners feel than how the pet feels.
Hines says these products aren't better for your pets.
The natural organic market is really marketing. It's not related to nutrition at all. Natural, as it's defined for pet food, is really broad. Basically, it's anything that's not synthetic.
But that marketing, it's really effective. It's led to Blue Buffalo sales rising by an average of 12% a year during the past 3 years. Chris Christopher with IHS Market says it makes sense for a company like General Mills, with its stagnant sales, to get into the growing pet food market.
You'd be sort of getting more of the aisles in a large grocery store.
And this is a growing market. Who doesn't want a bite of that? I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The minimum wage and the raising thereof is a perennial in the business and economic news cycle. But according to a new investigation from Politico, we might do well to start talking about what to do about enforcing existing wage laws first, specifically how to make sure workers get paid what they are owed, overtime, the right amount, or just not paid at all. It's a thing called wage theft. Marion Levine wrote the story for Politico. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If I feel then that I am a victim of wage theft, what do I do?
If you're a victim of wage theft, you have three options. You can either go to the Federal Labor Department, which has no obligation to take your case. You can go to a state agency if you happen to live in a state that has investigators who enforce minimum wage and overtime laws. Or you can hire a private attorney. But that option is difficult for low-wage workers since most people can't afford it.
Back up for a minute. The Federal Department of Labor has no obligation to take my case?
The Federal Labor Department has a tendency to prioritize cases that will affect the most workers and recuperate the most money because of the fact that they only have 894 wage and hour investigators in the country.
Okay, it's interesting you say they only have 894 wage and hour investigators in the whole country, because there are states, you say in this piece, that in fact have none, zero.
There are six states in the country that have no investigators who are devoted to minimum wage and overtime. Now, some of those states do have labor departments, and they do look into certain issues like child labor. But if you are not getting the minimum wage and you're not getting overtime, workers in places like Louisiana, Tennessee, and a couple others have the only option of either hiring a private attorney or going to the Federal Labor Department.
Okay, but if I'm making $9.42 an hour working whatever job I have, I can't afford a private attorney.
That's accurate. So it makes it really difficult for those workers who don't have that option. So what the only option they really have is to go to the Federal Labor Department, which may or may not take the case.
Do you have a sense of how widespread wage theft is in this economy?
It's difficult to determine how widespread wage theft is. We have studies from some left-leaning organizations like the Economic Policy Institute that estimated in a study last year that there's about $15 billion that's lost in minimum wage violations alone. But it is difficult to know how broad wage theft actually is, because one issue is many workers don't tend to report it because they're afraid of employer retaliation. Another issue is that it's just very hard to track. A lot of states don't keep track of data that would relate to this topic.
Who does wage theft? I mean, it's not like GE who's stealing people's wages, right?
It's hard to generalize who does wage theft, but a lot of the violations that affect workers are small contractors or small businesses. And oftentimes, these small businesses might not have a lot of assets themselves, so they can either go bankrupt or they can decide to transfer their assets and open under a different name. And so there's a lot of the organizations that workers work for are small companies that don't have the general counsels who are going to enforce, make sure that everyone's compliant with wage theft law.
This is an unkind thing to say about the American political class, but here goes. Minimum wage and raising minimum wage is a sexy political issue. Getting down into the weeds of wage theft and wage theft enforcement clearly is not.
And it's not as interesting as a political message telling workers, we're going to raise the minimum wage. That people understand immediately, but no one looks at what happens after you raise the minimum wage.
Marianne Levine, writing in Politico about wage theft and what's being done or not done about it. Marianne, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
There are a lot more freelancers or creatives, and they need a place to go all day that's not Starbucks.
Oh, yes, they do. But first, let's do the numbers. Ooh, the really happy music on a Friday. Here we go. Dow Industrial's up 347 points today, 1.3%, 25,309. The NASDAQ up 127, 1.7%, 7,337, and other palindromic numbers. The S&P 500 gained 43 points, 1.6%, 2747. Late week rallies erase losses for the 5 days gone by. Dow up 90 points, 0.3%. NASDAQ added 97 points, about 1.3%. S&P 500 added 15 points, about 0.5%. We talked about General Mills buying Blue Buffalo pet food for 8 billion simoleons. $40 a share that works out to. General Mills fell 3.5% on that news, as tends to happen. But Blue Buffalo shot up 17% to $40 a share. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The woes of the subway systems in New York and in Washington, D.C. have gotten a whole lot of press the past year or so, maybe more, actually. Fires and crashes, general deficiencies. But at least they're running for the most part. In Baltimore, the whole system has been shut down on purpose for a couple of weeks now to make emergency repairs. 40,000 people a day out of luck and a telling symptom of bigger problems in a city with deep economic inequality. From WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
At the Reisterstown Plaza metro station, loudspeakers are blasting WTTZ, the Maryland Transportation Channel. Yes, the Baltimore Metro has a radio station, but for the next few weeks, no subway service. I found Habib Malik standing on the curb waiting for one of the free shuttles running during the repairs.
Getting back and forth to work is kind of difficult because we don't know what time to come out here to catch the bus. I'm not even sure if the bus stop here or the bus stop over there, you know.
He gave himself an extra hour for a trip that normally takes 7 minutes. Today, Daisha Bunting was half an hour late to her job at Burger King.
They were understanding because, you know, they know the train is down right now, but I'm missing out on money.
Transportation headaches are nothing new in Baltimore. Last spring, the city revamped its bus system with new routes designed to be more efficient and reliable.
And we had the same exact problem where everybody was confused. They didn't know what bus to catch. And then they're raising the prices on top of that.
What we're looking at in Baltimore is systematic, gross underinvestment in the transportation system.
Samuel Jordan is president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. He says even when the metro is running, nearly 2 out of 3 jobs in the region can't be reached by public transportation within 90 minutes. He calls it transit detention.
Our calculations show that at minimum, the economy is losing about $325 million a year just in transit detention. The burden is borne always by people of color, low income, and households that don't have access to cars.
Former restaurant owner Jimmy Rouse says the unreliable transit system is costly for workers and businesses.
I ended up having to fire good employees who wanted to work because they couldn't get to work on time.
Rouse helped found the advocacy group Transit Choices to push for a better system. He points to a 2015 Harvard study that looked at patterns of poverty in the U.S.
And it showed that the number one obstacle for people rising out of poverty in this country was neither poor education or crime, but poor public transit.
Rouse says the new bus system will work better for Baltimore when the MTA installs GPS tracking and tackles worker absenteeism. When the city's one subway line is working, it's one of the more reliable ways to get around. Maryland Transportation Secretary Pete Ron spoke at a meeting with state lawmakers from Baltimore last week. The agency has added dedicated bus lanes and is coordinating service with large employers.
We are making record investments in transit right now. We're very much aware that there are many people who depend upon transit as their mode of getting around.
But the sudden subway shutdown has left those who rely on it, like Daisha Bunting in Northwest Baltimore, feeling neglected.
This area doesn't make a lot of money. So, you know, I feel like they tend to leave us out of a lot of stuff. They don't really care.
While we talk, a coach pulls up on the other side of a six-lane street. She and the others, hoping it's their bus, make a run for it. Subway service is expected to resume in mid-March, but another shutdown to repair worn tracks is scheduled for August. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Should you find yourself in need of a place to sit and work for a while, maybe take a meeting or something, a place where you can get a bite to eat as well that is maybe one step up the food chain from your local coffee shop that serves only pastries and stale bagels, meet the All Day Cafe. Christine Mulkey is editor-at-large at Bon Appetit magazine, also a regular patron of All Day Cafes. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
What are these places, All Day Cafes? I mean, where do they come from?
Where do they come from? Well, in other times, you might call them a diner. But now that we have all these creatives going on, they've become all day cafes. And, you know, I was able to trace it from two origins. One, Australia, where many good things around coffee culture and food come from. And, you know, that's where avocado toast comes from. A lot of the baristas were moving to Los Angeles, New York, opening their own places. And all of a sudden, you know, you'd see at a place like Bluestone Lane in Greenwich Village, what? There's a breakfast salad with kale? That's crazy. But apparently it's not crazy in Los Angeles. And you still can't get a seat there, really.
The roots are in coffee, as you say, but this is definitely not the Starbucks.
This is definitely not a Starbucks, although I would be curious to know what happens when Starbucks thinks about, maybe we should serve dinner or some natural wine. You know, to me, it also reflects a change in our work culture. There are a lot more freelancers or quote-unquote creatives, and they need a place to go all day that's not Starbucks because that's not acceptable to this group.
So it is all about the food, right? I mean, it's you can get the breakfast salad, but you can also get – I mean, there's eggs on here and as you said, wines and all kinds of stuff.
You know, it's funny. The food represents also this fascinating millennial split between, hey, yes, I'm working and I'm probably going to come here every day or 3 days a week. So I want to work clean. I want to be able to make it to 2 or 3 o'clock without, you know, falling over. But also some days they might be totally hungover and they want a burger, you know. So you these menus reflect both the super healthy, we'll call it the kale breakfast salad, but you can also get a burger. And yes, you can add an egg on that. You can have halloumi. You can have really typically seen as naughty moments as well. Everybody wants it all.
A lot of the people driving this are women.
Yes. And that's a great thing. You know, circling back to the idea of community, these are women who had their heads down in great kitchens for a long time. And one of the women I spoke with, Julia at Cafe Rose in Nashville, she'd spent almost 20 years in New York and spent years in fine dining also. And she said, I want to meet the people who are eating my food. She envisioned herself as a sort of French madame who's working the dining room and getting to meet all of her customers and getting to know their kids. And they're not imposing this, you know, beautiful, perfect, creative vision on you and making you sit through it for 12 courses of their design. It's, you know, how do you feel today? How do you want to eat today? And this is how I want to eat. And it's kind of healthy. And I pick a little here and I pick a little there. And, you know, let me share with you.
When you walk into one of these places and you close with an anecdote, but it's interesting that you say you feel very much at home.
I felt truly taken care of, you know, and that was, I got a little weepy, I have to say. I had a really crummy day, and I went into this place called Nourish on Greenwich Avenue. You know, from the way they treated me when I walked in to the way they you know, spoke to my child and kind of spoiled him, even though they didn't know him. Like, I really felt like I got a hug from this place, and I wasn't going to get that at a Starbucks. They weren't even going to spell my name correctly. I would have cried harder.
Christine Mulkey, she is an editor-at-large at Bon Appetit, writing about all-day cafes. Christine, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, the New York Times front page on this date, February 23rd, the year 1980. If I say, do you believe in miracles? Yes! You will know whereof I speak, probably if you're a certain age, actually. A picture on the front page of the Times of the U.S. men's hockey team celebrating after beating the Russians in the Lake Placid Olympics the day before, the Soviets, really, I should have said. Which is cool, especially in light of the U.S. women beating Canada this week in Pyeongchang for the gold. What caught my eye, though, business and economic reporter that I am, was a two-column headline right next to that picture reporting a month-over-month increase in inflation of 1.5%. We barely do that in a year now. Also, that the prime rate was a mind-boggling 16.5%. Think about that for a minute. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 1.3% today. The NASDAQ up 1.7%. The S&P 500 1.6% to the good. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.